From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today on the program, we're talking about death rituals around the world, like in Tibet, where bodies are eaten by vultures. Caitlin Doty says some of these rituals seem morbid or crass, but actually they help give families time and space to mourn, something we all could get better at here in the United States. Doty is a mortician, by the way, who has her own funeral home. She'll join us to talk about how to find a good death after this. Hey, it's Doug Fabrizio. Come see the latest in our film series, our partnership with the Utah Film Center. Next Monday, we're showing Madeline Olnick's film, Wild Nights with Emily. It's not a documentary. It's a narrative feature about the real Emily Dickinson. Olnick corrects these myths about Dickinson, that she was a delicate sourpuss. In fact, she says she wasn't. She was passionate and funny and inspired by love. Join us at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center next Monday night at 7. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. There's this human characteristic Caitlin Doty writes about in her latest book. Doty is a mortician, a really popular one. Her first book of observations as a crematory worker was a bestseller. Her YouTube channel, Ask a Mortician, has done pretty well, too. She says in the new book that humans have this thing where they appreciate and revere their own death rituals, but when they hear about the rituals in other countries and cultures, they get creeped out or outraged. Doty's on kind of a mission to reform the way we do death in this country. Not only change attitudes about death and dead bodies, but transform the medical culture and the massive funeral industry, which she says doesn't allow families the time or the space to mourn. But Doty says we can't really begin to reform any of those systems until we can come to look at the death rituals in other places as something other than being barbaric or disrespectful. So her new book explores the death rituals in other places. It's called From Here to Eternity, Traveling the World to Find the Good Death. Caitlin Doty is joining us today to talk about it. Caitlin Doty is a mortician, as I said, funeral industry activist, runs a nonprofit funeral home in Los Angeles. The book that I mentioned before is called Smoke Gets in Your Eyes, and she's joining us today from the studios of NPR in Culver City, California. Caitlin Doty, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Happy Halloween.
What do you think about the fact that we're doing this conversation on Halloween? And we will get to the difference between the American day and the Mexican day here later, but is it appropriate?
Sure. All I know is that I become very popular on Halloween. I don't really get to dress up and do anything fun because I'm usually doing interviews like this, because this is a time of year where people find it a bit more acceptable to engage with the darker parts of our world.
What is what did you want to do that was – I mean, I know that you want to explore death rituals, but what is it that you wanted different about this book from the memoir that I mentioned, Smoke Gets in Your Eyes?
Sure. The first book was really – it took place when I was 22, 23 years old, and I'm this young, fresh-faced, out-of-college girl who gets a job at a crematory. And at that time, everything was new. I'm working in this big industrial warehouse with these giant cremation machines humming all day, and all of a sudden I'm faced with mortality and the ins and outs of the funeral industry in a way that I had no idea about before. And honestly, most people have no idea about what's going on behind the scenes in the funeral industry. And when I started writing this second book, I had been in the industry for years. I now owned my own funeral home. And I was just trying to explore how we can push what we've done even farther, how we can reform the American funeral industry even more and be inspired by these other cultures, as opposed to, as you said, looking at other cultures and going, ew, how disrespectful and gross.
Yeah, yeah. Right up front in the book, you tell this story, I think, that illustrates how confused people are about the way this death thing is supposed to work. There's this hospice nurse you mentioned, who called you, I don't know, for advice. Would you tell this story? Because I think it really illustrates an issue, a problem.
Sure. And this is a particular story I tell. But unfortunately, a story like this happens quite frequently with what we do. So our funeral home in Los Angeles, we're really into family involvement. That's our primary motivator, is we want you to be involved in care for the dead. And most people aren't aware that it's completely safe and completely legal to keep the body at home if you want. If you don't want to have the big fancy makeup embalming wake at the funeral home, you can just keep mom at home for a couple hours or even a day and put flowers on her and put her favorite sweater on. And hospice workers, who are the ones who are actually there on the front lines when people are dying, are some of our greatest allies in this. But sometimes they don't quite get the message, or they don't quite understand the safe and legal thing. So in this particular situation, there was a daughter who really wanted to keep her mom at home. She wanted to take care of her mom like her mom had taken care of her. And we get a call from the daughter, and she's just frantic because the hospice nurse is telling her, oh, no, that's not legal. You can't do that. You have to have the funeral home immediately come in and pick up the body. And we had to tell her, don't tell this daughter that. Don't tell families that, because that's not the law and that's not true. And when in these situations, we usually just have to say, okay, I understand what you're saying. Show us the policy.
Yeah.
And they can't show us the policy because there is no policy. It's just word of mouth or general fear about the dead body. And eventually the woman got to have the experience she wanted with her mom, but it was a fight. And if she didn't have somebody like us who knew these laws on her side, she wouldn't have been able to do what she really wanted at her mom's death.
What is going on there, do you think? There's something that you say in the book that that this is cultural. What is the thing we're afraid of? Is it that we're afraid of the body being dirty, or is there some kind of religious squishiness coming into play?
Yeah, it's not religious. I would say the American funeral industry is not really based around religions. The customs that we have, which are pretty modern, like embalming and the big casket, those are not related to religion or the development of religion. It's really a capitalist endeavor, the American funeral industry. So just get that out of the way.
Yes.
And there was this time, you know, 150 years ago, where everybody was okay with keeping the dead body at home and very, very comfortable around the dead. And there's this theory that developed called miasma theory. And I won't get too deep into it, but basically it was the idea that anything that was dead or smelled or was rotting, like, you know, an overcrowded graveyard or sewage or trash heap, was floating deadness and disease off of it and infecting us. And we really got this cultural message around the late 19th, turn of the 20th century, that the dead body was incredibly dangerous. Of course, you know, spoiler, we now know about germ theory, and we now know that's how disease is spread. But it was really hard for people. It was the fake news of the time. It was really hard for people to move away from that idea and come into reality. And so the American funeral industry was founded around the idea that, oh, don't worry, we'll take your dead body and we'll sanitize it and make it safe for you.
Yeah.
The funeral industry is no longer allowed to claim that procedures like embalming actually do sanitize the body or make it more safe, because that's not, you know, scientifically correct. But that narrative persists in a very strong way for most people.
I've seen those really old photos and daguerreotypes of wakes in this country and other places where, you know, you had these bodies in some cases in Victorian times, for example, or later Victorian times, of children in homes. And I'm trying to compare that to the way it is now, because one of the things you write about in the book is that funerals used to be family or community run affairs, and it just seems so different today.
Yeah, they were 100%. And you'd die at home. you would be waked at home, and then the neighbors would make a wooden pine box, and you'd go on the shoulders of your community members to the local graveyard. And it was this very simple thing, and no one had a lot of money. You know, no one had set aside $15,000 for a funeral. Mm. That wasn't something that you spent money on in that same way. And again, we talk about the American funeral industry as being the quote-unquote traditional funeral, but it's not that traditional at all. It's a 20th century invention, but it's one that has worked very well. As far as marketing, it's worked very well because here we are, most people being unaware of the power and the self-reliance that they actually have around their own deaths and the dead bodies of the people that they love.
I mentioned this inclination we have to be repulsed by the way other groups handle their dead and think ours are great. Say a little bit more about that. You tell the story in the book about this French priest in Canada. This is, I think, in the 1600s, observing the death rituals of this indigenous people. Tell a little bit more about that. I think it's really interesting.
There was the second I read this story, it was like, oh, this is the story that describes in historical context what I'm talking about here. And it was just when people were coming over from France to try and convert these indigenous people in Canada, the Wendat people.
Yeah.
And there was a cardinal named Cardinal de Brébeuf. And he came and he was trying to convert them. And they had a ritual where when someone died, they would wrap the body in a beaver skin robe and put them up on this high platform. So they were basically exposed to the elements within this beaver robe. And at a certain time, I believe it was every 7 years, all of the different tribes would come together, all the different groups would come together to bury all the bones in a communal grave. And to do that, they had to go up and take down the beaver robe bodies, unwrap them, and take them down to bone. Some of them were already basically bone, and some of them were pretty fresh. So they had to scrape the bones, and the description's a little squiggy for the modern reader.
Yeah, it is.
But Cardinal Brébeuf, this you know Catholic priest, is looking at it and saying, wow, this is an example to inspire Christians. Look how lovingly they deal with their dead, how intimate they are with the bones, how involved they are. This is just so moving. And you read this and you're like, wow, this guy gets it.
He's enlightened.
And then enlightened. Yeah. And then a second later he goes, but of course they should stop every single one of these death traditions because they're not Christian and they're vile and they're you know, he goes right back into his entrenched narrative of how this is gross and wrong, even though he allows himself just this moment to talk about how beautiful it is. And then as sort of a subplot to this, what's so interesting is that these indigenous people, the Wendat people, are looking at Catholicism and saying they're talking about cannibalize, eating the blood and flesh of their own God. They're cannibals. Why are we going to convert to this religion? So it's just this pageantry of misunderstanding that I think really, really describes, I guess, what the rest of the book is about.
Yeah. I mean, just how narrow, as you put it in the book, just how narrow our idea is of what it means to be respectful.
Right. And respectful, and I think even worse, dignified is the word that gets thrown around a lot. And this is especially in the American funeral industry. There's a big funeral corporation called Service Corporation International that has trademarked the word dignity to use at their funeral homes and at their cemeteries. And dignity is such a dangerous word, I think, because it implies that some things are dignified. For example, paying the $10,000 for the embalming in the casket, and some things like cremation or just a simple natural burial are undignified. And that's not a thing that we want to set up as some things being dignified and some people's choices not being dignified.
I hope this isn't too much of a diversion as a question, but I do wonder, has it been difficult, Caitlin, to talk about what a good death means at a time when there seems to be so much news about so much, you know, bad death, you know, mass shootings and people dying in natural disasters? Does that complicate the way you've been thinking about or talking about all of this?
It does. This is absolutely a great question, and it complicates it in a positive way, in a strange way, because I have a group called the Order of the Good Death, and we're promoting the idea of the good death. And we've always had people say, "Oh, but doesn't that mean that if you have a bad death, you failed?" And I think this conversation is especially relevant now with all of the bad deaths we're experiencing. And I've had a lot of thoughts about this. And what I've come to is that if we are having all of this bad death, we just need to recognize that that is part of our landscape, and we need to work that much harder to make sure that these different groups in these different scenarios have an access to a good death on their own terms. We need to let the different groups speak for themselves, tell us what a good death would be, what's not happening right now, and let us get in there and address it and work towards it. I don't think we should forget the idea of a good death because there are so many bad deaths. We just need to expand. We need to bring in different voices and work that much harder to achieve, to still have the idea that a good death is possible for the people that don't have access to it now.
How did you decide which places to go? Seems like every country has a different idea about it. What were the criteria that you used to go someplace?
Yeah, right. Everyone does have their own death rituals. And I stopped writing the book because my editor was like, time to stop writing the book now. Like, yeah, I get
you're
that
just
there
using
100...
this as an excuse to travel the world.
Right, yeah. Right. I get that there are 195 countries, but you got to come home and actually write the book now. There was a couple things. I didn't want to go to places that I knew had been well covered. For example, the open-air pyres along the Ganges River in India are incredibly visually interesting, but you can kind of just walk up. I don't recommend you do this, but you can kind of walk up and see them and introduce yourself. Mm-hmm. And they've been well covered. There's a ceremony in Bali where this giant jeweled bull with rulers who have died inside goes rolling down the street, and then they set the whole thing on fire.
Wow.
Like Burning Man, to cremate the bodies inside. And that's also incredible, but I didn't know anyone there, and anybody can show up for that. Yeah. So the places I wanted to go had to be places that I had some kind of special access. Mm-hmm. I had some kind of person that I knew. So not only would I get this interesting story that another journalist wouldn't be able to get, but that I also had some kind of introduction to the family or to the people. So I wasn't just showing up and being like, oh, your dad died.
Yeah.
That sucks. Tell me more.
respectful access is how you put it.
Respectful access is how I've put it. Yeah, that's the way to do it.
So we should. It's funny, you don't begin with an exotic locale. You begin in Colorado.
And that was intentional because I originally started with the rural Indonesian chapter, which is much more exotic to our American understanding. But I had some friends of mine read it, and they made the very good point that it might be you might catch more flies if you start with something that people recognize.
Yeah.
More and they feel more at home with, and it's different, but it's kind of leading them by the hand out of America and into something more challenging.
You call Crestone, Colorado, but I think you say it's a morbid Mayberry.
Yeah, it's this amazing small town.
Yeah,
that is
describe
morbid
it
as heck.
Yeah, yeah.
Sure. So Colorado is Colorado. By the way, to start has some of the best death laws in the country. They're the most, and by best I mean the least regulated.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
So the most possibilities for what we do with our dead. And there's this small town called Crestone. It's only about 1,400 people total, and that's in the surrounding area as well. And it has all of these different spiritual traditions at play in this small town. And there's a group that came together. They're non-denominational, but they started a nonprofit called the Crestone End of Life Project. And what they do is they for $500, a donation of $500, which is unheard of in the American funeral industry. Yeah. When someone dies, they'll come to their house. They'll help prepare the body and lay out the body. And then everyone gathers from out of town. And a few days later, at dawn, they have an open-air pyre cremation for the person. And you can choose burial and you can choose other things, and the nonprofit will still help you. But you know, the real winner here, in my opinion, is the open air pyre, because it's the only public open air pyre in the Western world, not just America, in the entire Western world. And they have it down to a science. It's, you know, exactly how much wood to use. They know how to do it so the body isn't, you know, no charred arm is shooting up. It's very, I don't want to throw around respectful, but it's very, you know, it's not this visceral thing. It's quite a beautiful experience, with the smoke curling up into the air and the flames. And it really feels like you're witnessing a transition of someone in a way that you absolutely do not get in a modern industrial metal cremation machine.
Yeah. In that sense, you say you felt a touch of almost jealousy seeing when you went to Crestone, having your own experience, obviously, having worked as a crematory worker, and seeing them do this under, you know, an open blue sky and at dawn. And then you juxtapose that against what you had seen, you know, in the outskirts of town in some industrial place where this was happening.
Right. It's not a touch of jealousy. It's, you know,
a lot
more like searing jealousy. Yeah. Yeah. It really is, because here I am at our funeral home. As I mentioned, we really want family participation, and we really want to give families this interactive, meaningful death ritual. And we try to create that at our crematory. But no matter what we do, it's a little bit like lipstick on a pig. No matter what we do, it's still this warehouse with machines in it that burn natural gas and make noise. And the families still appreciate going in and being there for the cremation. But it's sure not like being able to process under the dome of Colorado sky at dawn into this circle of sanctuary where the body is set alight in its white shroud covered in juniper boughs. You know, it's just not that. And so I'm absolutely jealous, because talk about being able to create this beautiful, intimate, interactive death experience. They've nailed it.
Yeah. You say that in Crestone, the natural burial ground, they have a natural burial ground there. And that's open to anyone. But the pyre, they're a little bit more discriminating in the sense that this is for those in the community, which I thought that was interesting. They want this to be something related to them, I guess. The community part was important to them?
The community part is important, and they're not exclusionary, but what was happening is that they were getting calls from all around the country, Hindus, Native Americans, Buddhists, who want to come and want to, you know, ship their body in when they die to be cremated. And this is a small nonprofit volunteer-based organization, and they don't have the ability to just shuttle in out-of-town corpses do this. It really is a community initiative. And as much as that is hard for people outside the town, I actually admire that. I think I admire how much it is part of the community. And they have events where the community members come in and fill out their advance directives and sign up for the pyre or sign up for the natural burial ground. And that's why I called it a morbid Mayberry, because the people who run it will go to the post office and someone in town will just be like, hey, is Stephanie coming in to fill out my advance directive?
Right.
You know, things you don't normally hear in any town, especially in America.
Yeah. Cremation, you write, in one form or another, has been around for tens of thousands of years. You tell about the bones of an adult woman cremated, it's believed, something like 42,000 years ago.
Right. And not only that, so this was in Australia, and it predates our understanding of when the first people were even in Australia.
Yeah.
So, you know, not only that, it's this whole reframing of what we think about people in Australia. And they found her bones, and they had been twice cremated.
Right.
They had been cremated once and then cremated again. And we have this evidence. And this woman lived in a world that was totally, you know, there were giant emus that she harvested their eggs. So this woman being cremated in the way that, you know, people are still being cremated today, lived in an entirely different world with entirely different animals and entirely different landscape than we even know. But, you know, through all this is this ritual of cremation.
Yeah. The pyre experience you describe, seeing the experience in Crestone, all of them are different in some ways. They all have different, you know, aspects to them. But you say the one thing that seems to tie them all together is that they're transformative. What do you mean by that, transformative?
Yeah, it's hard to describe, and people would tell me that before I saw my first cremation, and I was like, okay, great. And it really is that, you know, in some cases they've had some really tragic deaths. There's one that I mentioned about a young boy who they were driving too fast in a car, mm-hmm. and it flips, and he's ejected, and he's young. I think he's maybe 19, and he's brought out to the pyre, and his mom uncovers his face and kisses it. And there's a moment where the dad forgives the driver of the car. And then the pyre is set alight. And everyone at first is really upset and crying. And then after a certain amount of time, there's a release. And this happened at the cremation I talk about, that I attended in the book as well, is that at first it's very quiet and there's just the flames. And then at a certain point, something seems to lift. Mm-hmm. And you've been so tense in the days leading up to the funeral and feeling your grief and doing the logistics. And all of a sudden it's just like, oh, right, this person isn't here anymore. And I can just unclench and be present and be here with the flames as they do their work. And it's hard to describe, but it's definitely there. And you can see the change in the crowd. And I would love to see, I don't want anyone in my life to die, but I would love to see what it feels like with someone you actually do love. I didn't know the woman who died, yeah. So I couldn't fully experience it. But I could imagine with someone like my mother, the feeling of intense grief and then this moment of, okay, I've accepted this. And she's going up into the sky. Even if I don't have a spiritual connection to it like that, it's still this sense. You can't help but feel that.
Caitlin Doty is with us. Her book is From Here to Eternity, Traveling the World to Find the Good Death. This email came from Matt in Logan this morning. He said, in Utah, the crowds, even the family, disperse before the casket is lowered into the ground. He writes, we've lost our human touch. I, myself, placed my father's headstone in the cemetery with my bare hands. Do you have alternative plans that you're considering for yourself or a loved one? Do you have a story about an alternative you found to the modern funeral industry? You can join us. We'll take a break and just be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. I'm Doug Fabrizio. This Wednesday night, we're wrapping up our speaker series about diversity in America, and we'll have with us Maria Hinojosa. Hinojosa is the host of NPR's Latino USA, and for years now, her coverage has been giving a voice to minorities and immigrants. Join us Wednesday night at the University of Utah's S.J. Quinney College of Law. It's our partnership with the United Way of Salt Lake City. You can get tickets or information by going to our website, KUER.org. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about death rituals around the world, like in Tibet, where bodies are positioned to be eaten by vultures, or in Japan, where the family lovingly picks through cremated remains with chopsticks. Caitlin Doty says some of these rituals at first may seem morbid or crass, but actually they give families time and space to mourn. So she's explored some of these various rituals around the world, and we're talking about her book that she's written about all of this. It's called From Here to Eternity, Traveling the World to Find the Good Death. Let's talk about Indonesia. it was hard to get there. You talked about how difficult it was and how exhausted you were at first. So that certainly lived up to the respectful access part. It was not easy to get there. But once you do, it's interesting, the death rituals, I don't know, it's kind of a thing. And I'm wondering if you were sort of disappointed by the kind of tourist gawking. People do go there to see some of these rituals. And I'm wondering what you made of that and how you navigated around that.
Well, there was part of what I saw there was not touristy at all, and I hope that it doesn't become touristy, yeah. Even though there I was as a white girl hanging out, yeah. And I hope they didn't see me as a tourist. I hope they understood why I was there. But another part of it in the larger cities in this area called Tana Toraja, mm-hmm. in South Sulawesi, they are very touristy, and it's a hard question to answer because they want the tourists there, yeah. Not necessarily because they want their funerals to be seen by everyone, but because there are other places in Indonesia, Bali, for instance, where tourism has made a huge impact on their economy. Yeah. And the people in Tana Toraja are going, wait a second, we are also beautiful. Mm-hmm. You know, where are the tourists here? How do we get the butts in the seats? Yep. And what they have that no other place has, even though they're incredibly hard to reach, is they have these amazingly impressive death rituals. So people come from all around Indonesia, as well as Europe, to see the, not so much America, but to see these funerals, which, you know, the one that I saw, they brought in the dead body of a local man who was pretty influential, mm-hmm. and they brought him in this giant coffin that was, you know, probably 20 feet tall, and it takes 40 men to bring it in, and they're, yes. thrusting it up and down and chanting and dancing, and then they believe that the person is still somewhat alive at this point, that they still, even though they're medically dead, that they're still with us, and then a buffalo has to be sacrificed, yeah. in order for the soul to be carried on. And so they sacrificed a buffalo, and the buffalo rips off of the rope and runs into the crowd bleeding. And it's this very intense experience. And of course, though, the tourists there are just like, ah, you know, yeah. how wonderful this, yeah. is, because they don't have any access to this kind of death where they're from. You know, it's just the cremation, like, mm-hmm. we talked about, mm-hmm. in the warehouse, or not seeing the body at all. And so it's hard, because on one hand, I have sympathy for people in really developed countries who don't have any access to being interactive with death or seeing interesting things around death. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, do we want to turn any death culture into tourist culture, even though the people in this part of Indonesia are themselves promoting it? It's not like people just show up and they can't stop them. They do want them there, but you could see the tensions even there, because, you know, there was a German woman who was just walking around with her iPad and shoving it in, mm. people's faces, mm. and taking pictures, and her Marlboro Red cigarette was hanging out of her mouth. And yeah. I was just like, lady, get out of there. Come sit down. So I think any place you go in the world where there is some kind of death tourism, or thanatourism, as it's called, yeah. you have to navigate these things. And it's a really complex question.
There's a ritual in Indonesia that you witnessed with these unwrapping these mummies, basically. I love that. Let me just quote you here. You said, the first mummy I saw wore 80s-style aviator sunglasses with yellow-tinted frames, which gives us a sense of sort of the tone of the book, which is really funny, aside from being insightful. But explain what's happening. They're unwrapping these mummies, and they're talking to, yes. these corpses.
Yes, and this is the part that was much less touristy. So as hard as it was to get to Tana Toraja, we had to continue on another, yeah. hour and a half to this very rural village to get there. So there's not really tourism there, and I hope that it stays that way, unless they want tourists there, in which case they should be able to dictate that. But what it is in these villages, when someone dies, they do mummify the dead body, either in an old way with teas and tannins and almost leatherizing the body, or in the new way, which is using good old embalmer's formaldehyde or formalin to preserve the body. And they do think that the person isn't really dead. My traveling companion, Paul Koudinaris, calls it a soft border between death. In America, we have this hard border where if you're dead, you're dead, and maybe you believe in an afterlife or prayer. But for the most part, the actual person in the actual body is not there anymore. That's not the case in Indonesia. They have a much more porous, soft border with death that can be transgressed. So every several years, they bring out these mummified bodies from their house graves, their graves that are shaped like little houses, and they bring out the bodies, unwrap them, and they take off the old clothes, they clean the bodies with paintbrushes, they hang out, they put new clothes on, they take family portraits, they talk to the body, they say, oh, your sister's coming tomorrow from the capital city. Yeah. Here, look, these people brought you some cigarettes, they're happy to see you, some people are crying. You know, it's quite a scenario, because it looks like a big family gathering that you might be completely used to seeing in America. There are just also mummies there. and it's, I will say though, that it starts to feel very normal pretty quickly.
Yeah.
And it's for someone like me, it's still astonishing and exciting, because I had come so far to see this very rare ritual that I thought I would never get to see. But it's guys smoking cigarettes with their friends. It's kids running around playing. It's people eating. It's people hanging out. You know, it feels very normal, and there happen to be mummies there.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you write that Westerners feel creepy about interacting with the dead over a long period of time, and that, you know, Norman Bates is the second scariest movie villain of all time. And as you point out in the book, it's not because he was a mass murderer that he was a terrifying villain. But it's because he talks to the dead body of his mother. I mean, we're really creeped out by that.
We are. We got lots of mass murderers in film culture. But why is he so scary? He's so scary because he keeps his dead mother around.
Yeah. Yeah.
And in Indonesia, a lot of them do that. Not in Indonesia, the country, but in this specific area of Indonesia.
Yeah.
They do this. Yeah, they keep mom around. And it's not creepy. It feels very normal, as I said. And something that the point that I wanted to make with that part of the book is the way that they hyper preserve their dead with these chemicals now is very similar to how Americans preserve our dead.
Right.
But we just immediately seal them in a casket and hide them underground, ne'er to be seen again.
Yeah.
So why are we being so aggressive with our preservation? You get it with these people in Indonesia. It makes sense. You know, they want to bring mom out and keep talking to her 7, 10 years later after she dies. They want to continue to have that access because they believe in this soft border.
Well,
if we believe in a hard border, why are we being so aggressive with
the
chemicals?
Well, you say that you get this question all the time from people who, when they learn that you're a mortician, they say, what would my mother's dead body look like now?
Mm-hmm.
I think that's really profound.
Yeah. People are really, really interested in what's happening with the physical body of someone they love. And you think I would get questions like, well, do you think she's in a better place? Do you think that she's moved? You know, you think I would get spiritual questions? I don't get that at all. What I get is people who want to know the intimate details of exactly what is happening with the 7-year-old, 12-year-old dead body of their grandpa who died in upstate New York. And of course, it's so hard to tell because everything affects it. The humidity, the temperature, the sealing on the casket, you know, everything affects what a body would look like, whether it was embalmed or not. So it's hard to give a straight answer. But the fact that people are so interested tells me that, you know, if we had an opportunity in this open, honest manner to let them check out mom and see what she looked like now, some of them would take it.
Yeah. I guess there's a kind of nice symmetry in the fact that we're having this conversation on Halloween and now talking about the Mexican death rituals associated with the Dia de los Muertos, which is that, I guess, celebration, you could call it, that happens in the beginning of November. It's happening. It starts tomorrow, I guess, in Mexico, right?
Yeah, there's a couple days leading up to it. There's a day for children, and then there's a day for adults.
Yeah. Where did this come from? It's interesting. You talk about kind of the arc of these rituals in Mexico, how for a time it looked like they might fall away, that it seems like they were influenced by, I don't know, by American Halloween, and the actual sort of integrity of the rituals themselves were maybe endangered almost?
It was, yeah. And this is a fascinating story that I wasn't really aware of when I traveled to Mexico. But what happened was, you know, Dia de los Muertos has been practiced for many years, and there's some debate as to how it really started and how long it's been happening. But it had in the 20th century, it had fallen away to very rural areas, and the intellectual elite in a place like Mexico City looked down on Dia de los Muertos. It was something that the rural folk did and the superstitious folk did.
Yeah.
But in the 1970s, Halloween was creeping down from the United States, and people were participating in it. And those same intellectual elite were saying, wait a second, we're not about to be influenced by the U.S. in this way. We're not about to adopt these witches and cats and goblins. That's not our connection with death. And so all of a sudden they're reintegrating Dia de los Muertos into these big cities. And over the next 30 years or so, it really becomes part of Mexico's national identity. And places that never had ever celebrated Dios de los Muertos are now bringing the full altars into the home. And it's become part of their identity as a country that's really comfortable with the idea of death and the idea of mourning. And it helps them not only with their national identity, but as tourism and as part of their cultural enrichment. And it's just become a part of everything. And, it's kind of nice to see, because it is so, so Mexican in how it's how it's used. But it's also, for me, as someone who, you know, is heartily approves of grief rituals being openly and honestly shared, it's a wonderful thing.
It also gives you a sense, this part of the book, at how important grief or these rituals are to the emotional health of people. Because you tell this really lovely story about this couple, Sarah and Ruben. And Sarah's son died when she was 6 months pregnant. Mm-hmm. And you write this. You write that while searching for comfort, Sarah landed on the doorstep of her own heritage. Say something about this moment, if you would.
Sure. Sarah's a very good friend of mine and colleague of mine. And I had known that she had some tragedy in her past, but I didn't really want to pry. And as we traveled to Mexico together, she is Mexican-American, she revealed this story to me of how her son had died in this very tragic way. And even more tragic than the death is the way that everyone just went silent around her after the death, and how she wasn't allowed to talk about her son's death because it bummed everyone out, because people don't like to think about children dying. And that makes sense, but it leaves a lot of people suffering. And she tried to find online forums and finally just settled on visiting Mexico, where they had this different relationship with death. And we were there. We went to this cemetery on the night of Dia de los Muertos, and it was just beautiful. It was just the marigolds and the candles and the fires burning and the music. And it just was this glowing, pulsing, vibrant place. And we would pass grave after grave where a baby had died. A baby. There was even a baby that I believe had died on her due date. And this, how open it was, how the parents were there with pictures and candles. And even years later, they were still openly talking about this child they had lost. It felt so comforting to her, because it was like, oh, here's a place where I don't have to hide the fact that I'm in grief. And I have to hide the fact that I lost this child that I was so excited to have and be a mom and be a part of its life. And to not have to hide your grief and your feelings in that way is transformative. And it's something that a lot of people do not get in America. And it's a shame.
Here's an email that comes from Rachel, who writes, I work as an ICU nurse in Utah County. I encounter deaths several times a month. She says, I see some good deaths, but I often struggle with what I consider bad deaths, that is, drawn-out suffering as family members desperately tell us to keep their loved one alive despite the costs. She writes, I wonder where today's expectations about life and death came from and why people seem so afraid of it that they're willing to go to a hospital for a long, drawn-out death instead of dying peacefully at home. What do you think?
That's a wonderful question. And, you know, thank her for the work that she does. Yeah. Because, as I said, some of our greatest allies are people on the front lines, like people in hospice or people in the ICU. Because they're really dealing with the families who they see firsthand the trouble that families have having this conversation. And I think that for me, what it comes down to is this period that I sort of briefly touched on earlier, but in the early 20th century, where there's the rise of the hospital, there's the rise of the corporate funeral home or the family-owned business funeral home, mm-hmm. and there's the rise of the slaughterhouses. And so all of a sudden, you know, you had before, you would die at home, you would have the wake at home, you would kill your own food at home, and then all of a sudden, all death is completely removed from society. And then you have World War I, which is this massive, massive tragedy, and by the end of it, nobody wants to talk about death anymore. Mm. Nobody wants to deal with it anymore. Science changes, medicine changes, and there's this amazing thing I found in the Atlantic magazine talking about, oh, there's life extension now, we're doing too much to save people, and it sounds like it could be in any editorial in the Atlantic today, and it was written in like 1953 or something.
Yeah.
So we've been dealing with this for the last 60 years at this point, this medicalization of death, and we're not doing a great job of figuring out how to have these conversations so that we don't reach the point where a family's frantically trying to save mom when mom has stage 4 cancer or mother's, you know, has no brain function and that she's not coming back. And somehow, whether it's how the doctors are talking to the families, whether it's the conversations that aren't happening in advance, somehow this message is not getting through and it's causing so much suffering. So part of what – I'm not specifically a medical educator, but part of what I do is just try to open up the conversation so we don't – by the time they get to the point that she mentions where they're frantically trying to keep someone alive, hopefully they're not so terrified of death that having the person suffer seems like a better option than death. Than the peaceful drifting away into death.
There's an idea you write about in the book, holding the space for the dying person and their family. And at first, it's interesting. You sound like kind of a skeptic too. I mean, you say you have this very secular disposition, and so at first you thought the idea sounded a little maybe saccharine or cheesy. But at some point, you say you realized this is exactly what we're missing. This idea of holding space. What is it, do you think?
Yeah. When I started, so I work with people. I own my own funeral home and I'm very secular, but I work with a lot of people in the more alternative death industry who, you know, use sacred oils to anoint the dead person and have this very spiritual connection to it. And they talked about holding the space. And I was like, yeah, okay. That's something you're doing with your chakras. All right. Yeah. But the more that I'm traveling and the more that I'm seeing these different things. So just about what we talked about, you know, on your show today, think about at the cremation, at the open air pyre cremation in Colorado, they had these beautiful bamboo walls around the pyre that holds everybody in and then the dome of blue sky. And it just felt like whatever emotion you were going to have in that moment held in around the fire was going to be okay and acceptable. And then you have the cemetery at Dia de los Muertos with the glowing candles, thousands and thousands of them, held in by the wrought iron fence of the cemetery. So once you enter that cemetery, you're in a place that it's okay to have any feelings or emotions or grief that you want to have. And it occurs to me just how few spaces in America we have that are like that. When you go to an American funeral home, You know, it's a big, often somewhat architecturally dated space. And you go in and you have to file past the casket and tap mom's hand and move along. But there are people watching, and it doesn't feel to me like a place where anything goes. Because death can bring up strange things, weird and wonderful and dark, and you know, any number of things can come up. And we need to be creating spaces where when someone comes in, whatever happens is safe and okay. And that's what I think holding the space means.
Yeah.
It's just creating the space for people to truly feel what they need to feel, good, bad, ugly, etc.
You also say it's about showing up. That it doesn't mean, as you put it in the book, swaddling the family, immobile in their grief. It's like getting them moving and giving them a task.
Giving them a task, yeah. You mentioned the bone, putting the bones, picking the bones with chopsticks and putting them in the urn in Japan. Or cleaning a mummy in Indonesia. Or going up and putting the juniper bough on the body, on the pyre, just something to do that you're a part of it. You're not just, you know, again, filing into the funeral home, taking your seat and flipping through the program. That's not interacting with the death. That's not a ritual. You need a ritual. And I don't think that ritual necessarily has to mean religion. Mm-hmm. It absolutely can. And isn't it nice for people with, you know, strong religious beliefs, with strong rituals, who know exactly what to do? But for those of us who don't have that, we can still have ritual. We can still show up. We can still be present. We can still be interactive in some way. And it still feels good, and it still feels like a transition, and that you're involved, even if it's not based in religion.
Caitlin Doty. Her new book is From Here to Eternity, Traveling the World to Find the Good Death. She joined us from the studios of NPR in Culver City, California. Caitlin, thank you very much for the time.
Such a pleasure. Thank you.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Anthony Scoma. Technical direction from Tim Slover. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.